Today, exposing financial propaganda. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. In today's post, I'm joined by John Adams, our pet economist. And today, we're going to talk about household debt and all things to do with whether there's an issue or whether there's not an issue. Hello, John. Good to see you again.
How you going, mate?
I'm very good. So here we are once again.
We are.
And I want to start by saying that household debt is really in the headlines at the moment. There's a lot of people writing about it, a lot of people talking about it. Why is household debt such a critical question?
Well, I think we've covered that in some of our previous episodes. We have a very big structural imbalance in this economy. We have record household debt compared to disposable income, household prices compared to disposable income. And obviously, when you look at economic history, these levels of debt are unsustainable, and they are likely, in my view, to cause significant economic havoc once something blows up, either in the domestic economy or overseas. And obviously, one of the big drivers is the RBA's interest rates. And, you know, I wrote a column for The Spectator Australia last year, and where I basically said that the RBA was trapped in a debt trap because interest rates are at record lows and they can't actually bring the cash rate to long-term averages, because if they did, it would cause a significant crash in the housing market and the household sector.
I'd like to add to that, that with so much debt being serviced by households, that level of debt sucks air out of the rest of the economy because people don't have the money to spend in the shops or to do other things. So effectively, not only is there a direct impact on the household, but there's also an economic impact as well.
Of course, some people like Max Kaiser, they call this a debt saturation. So once you flood an economy with so much debt, the debt consumes everything else. And that's basically what we're seeing at the moment. Obviously, there's been a number of people in the in the press, in the headlines, saying that the situation isn't as bad as what you and I have been saying in previous episodes. Some of those commentaries are quite dangerous, because I think it has the potential to lead to complacency among various households about what is the real nature of the Australian economy.
Yeah, there almost seems to me to be a bit of a fight going on, right? As more people are writing about debt, then we're seeing a number of people saying, no, there's no problem, it's all fine. And you've also got other people saying, no, actually there are some significant issues, right? And it's like everybody's just upping the ante, without necessarily being focused on the data that's driving the opinions. It seems to me there's a lot of opinions out there with not much else.
Of course, and obviously one of the, I wrote an article recently, and I think we're going to talk about it later in the episode today, about, a couple of columnists have written this thesis about net household debt, which is once you consider household debt with household deposits, the situation is pretty good. It is not as dire as what you and I have been saying, but I wrote an article which sort of, you know, tore that thesis to shreds. And I think it's quite important, as you and I have been saying, is that, you know, the viewers shouldn't necessarily follow what I'm saying or what you're saying, but they should actually assume responsibility and actually do their own homework and actually look at the various opinions in the market and make a determination as to, what makes sense, what is real, what's data-driven and supported by evidence, and what is not, and then for people to make their own decision.
So let's talk about some of the data that's out there, right? And let's try and work out whether it's real or whether it's not, right? So I guess the one that everybody's quoting is the RBA data at 190, right?
Yep.
Let's explore that for a bit, shall we?
Sure. So the, you know, as of March of this year, the RBA released their household debt to income statistics, and it came in at 190.1%. So that is gross debt to income, and household debt is sitting at about 2.34 trillion. So these are record highs, and the debt to income ratio is a clear example to me of a clear structural imbalance between how much debt the average household has relative to the amount of income. And obviously, because it is a average, there are some households which are well above 190% to disposable income, and obviously there are some that are less. So the question is that for those that are at that 190 level or more, how many people are there at those levels, and how much trouble are they in, and how sustainable is their a situation, and if those people end up in sort of mortgage stress or default, what systemic risk does that pose to the broader economy?
Right, so you could actually have an average where there's just a few who are really, really highly exposed, or you could have an average where quite a large proportion are over the median point, as it were, right? And you still get the same result. So
indeed,
you have to get granular. You can't just take the top level line number and say, see, there's a problem, or see, there's not a problem. You have to get into more granularity to really see what's going on.
Indeed. And so when you think about the gross household debt, I mean, 190%, it's basically people are borrowing basically double their income. But I think even from your data and some commentary by Lindsay David from LF Economics, there's a whole range of people that have borrowed 7, 8, 9, 10, up to 11 times plus their income. So there's clearly people who, in theory, could be a gross household debt to income ratio of 1,000%. Now, there's obviously a whole bunch of other people, particularly people close to or in retirement, who would probably have little to no debt. So their gross debt to income ratio would be sort of zero or 10-20%. So you've got a very big range, and obviously what we'll be discussing is who is holding that debt and what does that sort of mean for the economy as a whole.
So should we go and have a look then at who's holding the debt? Is that a good place to go next?
Well, I think why don't we sort of start with today's report that came out by ME Bank. They came out with their 2018 survey results about the financial snapshot of the household sector. And, I had a look at that report this afternoon, and there was quite a few statistics in there that was quite scary. I've been in contact with certain politicians in federal parliament already about that report. And I basically sort of said that the results of the report are basically inconsistent with what the Prime Minister and the Treasurer is actually telling the Australian public about the nature of the economy. So there was a number of statistics in there that was quite scary. People very concerned about levels of debt. The proportion of net savers in the economy has actually fallen. So more people are spending more than what they're generating as opposed to saving. People have felt that their situation is much worse in terms of the cash flow situation, but also their ability to maintain living standards and cost of necessities is a clear factor that is coming through. So cost of living, whether it's childcare, utilities, etc., cost of necessities is something, and obviously transport, petrol. Yeah, I mean, look at petrol prices at 150, 175. I mean, these historically are very large levels for households to fill up their cars. At the same time, you got childcare quite high, electricity and water quite high, and then you put debt on top of it, and enormous amounts of people being squeezed. So while the Prime Minister and the Treasurer are saying that jobs and growth, they've met their employment target, they've met their economic growth is quite robust. The day-to-day experience in the economy, it is so pinched tight in terms of what people are actually feeling. I think the political ramifications of that are quite profound.
Well, it's interesting because we run our Financial Confidence Index, which is trying to get a handle on how people are feeling about their financial situation. And the index is as low as it's been for a long, long time, 4 or 5 years, in fact. And in that survey, we find those same things. So the number one concern is just the cost of living, right? And the ME one said, I think about half of the households were really worrying about that now. Well, we see similar numbers in our survey. And we also look there at the question of debt servicing, not just the mortgage, but all of the debts that households have, because of course you have to look across the whole of the household rather than just just the mortgage sector. And again, the concerns there, plus savings are not returning as much as they used to. Interest rates on savings are very low, and now they're also starting to see their net worth getting dented as well as house prices begin to slide.
That's
right. So you put that all together, and the overall view of households with regard to their financial confidence is a lot lower than it was a little while ago.
there are people even today who are out on social media, on Twitter, basically saying that mortgage stress is close to a record low and that there are no issues. And obviously, you know, people putting these opinions out there, you know, it's quite staggering with you know, your data, with the government's actual official data, and what these independent reports are saying with ME Bank, that people are still saying that mortgage stress is record low. I don't understand how some commentators can make comments of that nature.
And of course, the Hilda data that came out last week also said that, again, more households were in financial stress as well. So a lot of the more established data sets, as well as the DFA data, is all pointing in the same direction. And yet it seems to me, as we get more evidence to suggest that we've got issues, we've also got more people on the other side of the fence saying, no, everything's fine.
Yeah, and so I do think that the question of, you know, how many of these commentators are independent, how many of them are sort of being guided by vested interest to potentially put out particular views. That's actually, I think, covering some of the public debate. And again, I think it's you know, incumbent on, you know, people watching this program, but also, you know, the general public to, you know, not to take anyone's word on face value, but to look into the issues more deeply. But again, you know, independent of people doing their own research, I think just the ordinary day-to-day experience for households, I think when they see people say in the public domain that there is no issue with the mortgage stress, I think for most people that doesn't pass the pub test.
It's worth just highlighting, right? The DFA data says that of the about 3.3 million households with an unoccupied mortgage, about 30% of them have difficulties at the moment. So they're in stress. In other words, their cash flows, money coming in, money going out, mean that they're really struggling to make those repayments. They're not going to default tomorrow, but it just highlights the amount of stress in the economy. And in fact, that number is as high as it's ever been since I've run the series, right? So it's not uniform across the whole of households. There are households with no problems at all, particularly those, of course, there's about a third who are not borrowing at all, and there were about a third who are renting, and there are about a third who have mortgages. And even in the whole household set of people with mortgages, only 30% of them are in significant difficulty. But it's that marginal borrower that seems to me to be the critical issue. So you wrote the article the other day, and you really, I think, went to town on some of the arguments. So let's start there, and let's go through some of the arguments, shall we?
Sure. So there was two particular columns. There was a column in The Australian in June by a guy called Don Stammer, and then there was an article in The New Daily in July, which was basically putting out the same thesis, which is to say that once you consider net household debt, which is gross debt minus deposits, what you and I have been talking about in these programs is basically irrelevant, because we're only looking at the debt equation and we're not considering in terms of the deposit equation. So their thesis is that, you know, yes, household debt is at 2.34 trillion in terms of March of this year, but deposits is 1.07 trillion. And so once you consider the debt to the net debt position, you know, rather than 190% to 190.1% to disposable income, it's more like 100%. And they're basically saying, well, see, 100%, no problems. So the doom and gloom sayers, you know, have no case. But so I wrote an article that basically tried to examine that thesis, because particularly when I read the first article in The Australian, it was a very superficial examination of the issue. It didn't really examine the composition and the distribution of, in terms of the debt and the level of deposits and where those deposits are sitting. And I thought it was a very misleading article. So I wrote this, obviously, article, and we'll obviously include it in the notes in YouTube, so for people to read my view and for people to make their own view in terms of their own judgment. But I came up basically with seven arguments that basically tore this net household debt thesis apart. And so the first element is that of the $1 trillion, there's about $90 billion, which is associated with unincorporated enterprises, which is basically sole traders and partnerships.
So what you're saying is that top level number is not just households, it's households and firms.
Yes. Right. So firms that are not incorporated.
Yep.
So they're included. So that's a part of the ABS definition, which the RBA has also assumed. So yeah. So you got about $90 billion. Now, with that $90 billion, I mean that's obviously tied up in working capital for business. PAYG tax, GST, putting provisions away for employee entitlements and super. So that $90 billion, households that are running small business, you can't take that money out of the business to service your own mortgage, because what's that actually going to do to your business? So business owners have certain legal responsibilities around provisions, around the payment of tax. So we can easily just initially cross off that $90 billion, saying, well, that of the 1.07 trillion, completely relevant. And so when you actually do that, the household debt, or so the net household debt excluding unincorporated enterprises relative to income, is about 111%, which is about 59% of gross household debt. So that was point number one. Point number two is, when you look at the distribution of who's holding the debt, who's holding the income, who's holding the deposits, you see a very big difference in that distribution. So there was a bunch of data from the RBA, which was from 2014, which is their latest series, that clearly showed that the elderly, so close to retirement or in retirement, as well as the wealthy, hold the bulk of the deposits, whereas people under the age of 55 hold the bulk of the debt. So there's a clear difference between people who have access to cash and versus those who are holding the debt and actually need the cash.
So that tells me that effectively you can't just offset the debt against the deposits, because they're held by
different people. That's right.
Right. So yep. You're either going to be somebody with a large amount of debt and no deposits, or very little deposits, or you're going to be someone with lots of deposits and no debt.
Precisely.
You can't just mash them together, because effectively you're comparing apples and pears.
Indeed. So the 2014 RBA database has said that if you're under the age of 44 years old, you have about $8,000 of household deposits on average. Whereas for the 45 to 54 category, you had about $10,000. So you still have some level of deposit on average. But I think even your DFA data set says that people with mortgages have, a big chunk of them have less than 20,000 in deposits. So you may want to say something on that.
Yeah, well, some of them have offset accounts. In other words, they will hold a certain amount in an offset account because they can reduce the interest they're actually paying on their mortgage. Others don't have that. And what I found is that those who are in a more distressed state are precisely those who do not have significant deposits. So again, you can't just average across even all mortgage holders, because effectively mortgage holders are in all sorts of different states. But you certainly can't say total debt minus deposits means it's a much, much lower number at the aggregate level. It's meaningless. You've got to actually go down to individual households. And some households have no savings. There's around 35 to 40% of households, according to the DFA data, that has less than 1 month's savings.
Yeah,
based on their outgoings.
Yeah,
they've got no safety net at all.
Indeed, and that corresponds very nicely with the RBA data. I mean, one of the assistant governors in February gave a speech about household debt, and according to the 2017 data, about 27% of households have paid less than 1 month in advance. So it is around that 27 to 30% mark where people don't have a buffer. Mm. And obviously, the question is that if the economy takes a turn for the worse, if that bulk of people started to default, what is the systemic risk for the broader economy, but also for the banking system, and whether that will actually implode the economy, or whether the economy could handle that chunk of people sort of going under or not?
So the critical point there is that most of the households that I've looked at tend to have two incomes, right, to pay the mortgage.
Yeah.
So they are reliant on two jobs, or in fact multiple part-time jobs, to be able to bring sufficient income in to be able to make those mortgage repayments and also manage the rest of the cost of living. And so only a marginal movement, so if one of them lost one of the part-time jobs, for example, that would actually then put them over the edge.
Yeah.
Very finely balanced for many households at the moment.
Indeed. So we've talked about the unincorporated enterprise, and we talked about the distribution of deposits and debt. So obviously one of the other big factors is the conversion of interest only to principal and interest loans, which was, I think, even the Sydney Morning Herald sort of talked about is coming over the next few years. So the RBA assumes that that's going to increase repayments on average by about $7,000. So for those, and obviously, you know, I think in the 2013 to 14, 15, 16 period, a whole chunk of those loans were interest only. So a lot of those households that will go through this process over the next couple of years, their cash flow position is going to dramatically change. Now, the question with that is that, well, for those that don't have a deposit, or have little deposits, they're going to be really squeezed. And those who may actually have a healthy deposit, I mean, if they don't have the income to service those higher repayments, they'll have to start drawing down on those deposits, which obviously takes away from this net household debt argument. So that's obviously number one. Number two is that when you look at in terms of variable interest rates, well, the RBA emailed me earlier this year and said that about 80% of the household sector as of November last year was on variable interest. So we're obviously seeing that the Americans in particular are very aggressive with raising interest rates. And I think late last week, the UK raised interest rates again. So as we see inflation starting to increase around the world and interest rates going up, no matter what the RBA does, interest rates are going to start to go up via the banks because of the international funding costs. And that's obviously going to start eating into people's savings, if they have any savings, because repayments are going up. So that's obviously another factor against saying that if people have a healthy level of deposit at the moment, that things will be fine moving forward.
And postscript on that, a few people have been in touch with me about this issue and said, well, that's okay. If the official rates go up, there will be some adjustment on the other side. So effectively the net repayments won't go up as far. And I'm saying, how does that work, right?
Indeed. And so the following point is obviously about the cost of living. So cost of living is obviously, going up. So whether it's your data, the Hilda data, or the ME Bank data that came out today, with the cost of necessities in particular going up, that's going to eat into household budgets. People don't have enough income to meet those repayments, and that's obviously going to eat into savings at the moment. So again, while we haven't had a dramatic economic event yet, those deposits and those savings are starting to be chewed into because of rising cost pressures. So that's point. I think point number five. Point number six is obviously, if we did have an economic shock and people started to lose their jobs, which is a point you just made before about people dependent on multiple sources of income. Well, if people don't have a job or don't have income at the moment, and they have expenditure requirements plus the debt repayment requirements, where they're going to heavily draw down on their savings. So the question is that in that situation, I think you may see a delay in people potentially defaulting or getting into serious financial strife. But I don't think it's going to prevent the inevitable in terms of occurring. So I think the ability to rely on employment conditions at the moment can dramatically change very quickly. And if enough people were to see a significant change in their sort of hours or their income or even their whether they have a job or not, those at risk at the moment will definitely sort of go under. But those who look healthy at the moment, those sort of people will quickly go to the margin and then go and default quite quickly. And I think this is what you saw, particularly in the American situation leading up to the GFC. The subprime crisis started in sort of late 2006, 2007, and people at the margin started to get into trouble, and that started to cascade. And then obviously as rates went up and you start to see Bear Stearns defaulting in, say, March of 2008, more and more people started getting pushed in the margin. And then obviously when Lehman Brothers went under, a whole bunch of people who in, say, 2006, 2007 looked pretty good by September of 2008, well, those were people who were already in trouble as well. So it's the situation can ravel quite quickly. And again, I think this is very dangerous where you get commentators putting these very superficial pieces out in the public domain, saying there's no problem. People read them, particularly in the Australian, and people think that there's... that everything is fine. We can continue to live the current lifestyle that we're currently living with the debt obligations, etc. And no one's actually sort of calling out the risks.
So Warren Buffett said, "When the tide is out, you can see who's been swimming naked." Right?
Yeah.
And I think that's a really good quote, because basically, if the tide is in and everybody's thinking there's no problem, then you might get away with it. But as soon as things start to recede, then essentially you start to get exposed. And the other point that you've made there, and I think it's worth re-emphasizing, is this is a downward spiral, just as it's an upward spiral with bigger debt means more house prices, means bigger debt,
Yeah, exactly.
The other is also true. As house prices go down, the debt level decreases. And therefore, the spiraling down can actually happen quite quickly. And what that means is that you don't just get a one-off event. It's a series of events over a period of time. And in fact, the whole US evolution to the point when the GFC was really sort of registered was about 2 years.
Yep. And in my article, the last point I made was that even if you assumed the net household debt thesis that 100% or 111% was okay, well, when the GFC happened in America, household debt to income registered in 2007 at 138%, according to the McKinsey Global Institute. So you think to yourself, well, if the Americans got into strife at 138% and the net position is 111%, that's still close to the mark. So that's pretty scary. But obviously, once you start to pull apart a lot of these factors that we've been talking about in this discussion, you realize that the gross figure, which is 190%, is a big marker, particularly for that under 55 category. And a lot of those people, if they get into sufficient trouble, can have massive systemic effects for the broader economy. So again, I think it's important for people to read widely, consider the arguments of various people, but when people, particularly potentially driven by vested interests, are putting out, what I would call fake financial news, I think it's incumbent on people to, not fall for those traps that you're sort of seeing in the press at the moment.
So I think you're absolutely right. And my sort of parting message is granularity is really important here, right? You can't just take an average number out of the air and say, see. You actually need to come down and look at the moving parts of it, which of course is what we do in the DFA surveys, because effectively there are some huge variations amongst households. And you could actually start looking across postcodes, you can look at across states, you can look across different types of households. And what you discover is there are pockets of pain in all sorts of places, not just at the bottom end, not just amongst the battlers, but even among somewhat affluent households too. So it's really important to not just swallow the top level, top line number, but actually get into a little bit more understanding of what's really going on. And I think the other point to make, which is the one you made earlier on, just to reiterate, it's really interesting talking to individual households about their real situation. And I find that more households are saying, well, I don't know about this official CPI number. It's nothing like what I'm really experiencing now. My cost of living is so much higher, and I'm really having to dial back what I can spend. So, again, I think the official statistics don't tell you the full story.
So I agree with that. And I think, when you just look at the political situation, the disconnect between the government's narrative on the economy relative to the day-to-day experience, like we said earlier in the program, I think it is quite different. And I think just to wrap up the conversation, I think it's, for some reason in this country, the saying that she'll be right has been the hallmark of our culture for a very long time. And that to me, is very dangerous because it leads to complacency. And I've always held the view that it'll only be right if you make it right. And obviously just to assume that things are going to be right, I mean, that complacency and propaganda pieces that induce that complacency can catch a lot of people caught out because they're not aware of the risks.
So we can really call this then, fake news, right? So some of these high level, oh, it'll, everything's fine, is really fake news.
Absolutely.
John, thank you very much. Good to spend time with you.
No problems.
So the truth is, there is a lot more to this debt question than just a high level headline. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for spending time with us and for watching this video. If you like what you've seen here today, please do like the post and also consider joining our Patreon program, where you can contribute to us making more of these programs. Also, we'll put the link to John's article directly on the site, so you can go and look at that. And you can also see our other videos, which are also on the site. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you next time.